Hi, my name's Charlie. I'm an alcoholic. I made this up. I hate to do this on my own. I always try to figure out who the sound guy is because they get that. And they move the microphone, they start getting out of their seat. Anyway, this is great. I'm happy to be here. I want to thank John and Kathy for inviting me. And my wife and I were in Georgia last year and love your state. So I'm really happy to be able to come back and enjoy it again. If you're brand new, I'm supposing there's probably some new people in here, you've landed in a good group. You've landed in a place where people stay sober and the fellowship's alive and the traditions are alive and the steps are alive. And that's where you want to be. And I found that out because I'm in one of those groups too. And there are plenty of spaces in between those groups. But if you find one where the people are focus on Alcoholics Anonymous and focused on upholding the traditions and can still tell a filthy joke over dinner, you're in the right place. I had dinner with John and Kathy and Ann, and I have a whole new vocabulary. Just kidding. I drank badly. That's how we used to get here. And I'm an alcoholic. I have no other issues. I've searched to try to find some other way to find out that there was maybe another problem, and maybe I'd gone too far in diagnosing my alcoholism, that perhaps I overdiagnosed. You know how that feeling is when you get to AA, you're desperate. I got here, I was peeing blood, which is a problem. And it's a tangible problem. It's not just like you have an adjustment problem or an attitude problem. You got a real problem. And it's a problem you can't tell anybody about. You can't tell. How you doing? How was your weekend? I don't know. I just been peeing blood all weekend. You don't do that at work. Nobody wants to hear it. You can't tell anybody that. And I bet if we went to the survey through the room, but I don't have enough time right now, but everybody in here knows when they came in here, they had something they couldn't tell anybody about. You couldn't tell anybody about it. And I think that, you know, when we read about alcoholics being the loneliest people in the world, it's not because we're not around people. I had a therapist who said, if you feel lonely, you should go out and be around people. Buy yourself something nice. You know what? The last thing I want to do when I'm lonely is be around a bunch of them. Because I hate people. As a species, I don't like people. I never have. I find them despicable. I read the newspapers and see what they do to each other. It just makes me sick. I don't want to be a part of that. And yet, on the other hand, I demand their approval all the time. Get away from me. You're disgusting. Your values are, you have no character. You really irritate me. Wait, where are you going? You know, that kind of back and forth, that emotional slinky that you get going, and you know what it is, and you can't tell anybody. I can't tell people that I hate people, because that's socially unacceptable. I was raised by a good family. My dad was a Marine Corps drill instructor for 8 years, and my mom was a housewife. My dad was a carpenter as a career, and I like to say my mom was a humble virgin woman, you know, on the other hand. And I was an only child. I was born on the wrong side of the manger, apparently, because I've never been happy. I never really understood what it was like to be happy. I always felt like something is missing. Something's just not quite. Maybe if I had enough, you know, we didn't have a lot of money, a lot of stuff. But we had enough stuff. I didn't know it, though, because I wanted more. And my dad had a fifth grade education. My mom had about a seventh or eighth grade education. And they wanted the best for me. And I just didn't get it. I didn't like being here. I didn't want to be alive. My mother had three other babies besides me that she carried full term, and they all died at birth. And there were two before me and one after. And I always thought, why me? You know, why not one of them that could have made it instead of me? I don't want to be here. I never wanted to be here. But you can't tell anybody that. And I was a nice little boy. I was a nice kid. I was not a troublemaker. I was not a tantrum thrower. I was not spoiled. I was not a little punk. I was respectful of my elders because I was taught to be. I grew up in a good community where people respected each other and where everybody was lower middle class and everybody worked. The dads worked, the moms stayed home. They sent the kids to school, and I grew up in that kind of a community. And but I still never felt like I was getting it. Something not right here. And I went to school, and I had something in abundance that a lot of people didn't have, and I'm sure a lot of you had it too. And that's potential. I must have had more than most people because I heard it so often from everybody. You know, in fact, they bring my mom and dad into the office, you know, like the counselor's office, and sit there and they'd flip open that big folder that they used to have. Now it's on computer, I guess, but in my day they used to have a big thick folder and they'd look at it and go, yeah, okay, yeah. You know, Charles has a lot of potential. We just don't understand why he's not doing anything with it. And my reaction was always the same, and that is that I know I've got potential. Obviously, you know I've got potential. Now my parents know I've got potential. Thanks a bunch. All God's children apparently know I've got potential, and I will use that potential when I'm goddamn good and ready to use it. When I do use it, I hope you've got sunglasses on, Skipper, because I'm going to light you up. But until then, you might want to take your concern for my potential and go wipe it on some other sap. Because if you were such a big deal, you wouldn't be a high school counselor, would you? It never came out exactly those words. I usually said something like, I'll try harder. But So I went through life as some of us do, a secret rebel. You know, I was rebellious. I just didn't tell anybody. And I went through high school and got out with no notoriety whatsoever. And never had a girlfriend in high school. Went on a lot of dates, no girlfriend. Did a lot of things, never accumulated any kind of reputation for anything good. I just did the stuff and I got out and I felt, I didn't know what to do. I did not know what to do. My friends are going off to college and off to careers, and I'm still in Anaheim, which is the city that can't be underestimated for those of you who've never been there. And I got into the record industry, the music industry, just sort of by a fluke. But I was a clerk in a record store. But I was working there, and these guys came into the store and they asked me if I wanted to go to a party. And I knew them from high school, and they were sort of the hoodlums of my high school for those days. That was back in the 60s, and so I thought, party? Well, I would certainly love to go to your party. My head, no way, I don't go to parties. Clearly, there are going to be other people at the party, and that's just not going to do. I'd never been to a party before. I don't party. I'm not into fun. I grew up Catholic. Life is serious. Jesus' 12 best friends got crucified upside down. What's that leave me? You know, I'm a nobody and a nothing. Okay, I'll go to your party. Anyway, so I got my buddy. I have one, because we always have one friend. Because when they make a new friend, we feel cheated on. We go find another friend. But I took my buddy John, and he took me, drove, and went to this party. And everybody was drinking. It was 1968. I just turned 18. Things were happening at this party, except I wasn't. And I was standing by the wall. I was standing there thinking, look at these people. This is exactly why I don't go to parties. They're a bunch of miserable, self-focused, hipster, ferret-faced little bastards. I can't stand the sight of them. It makes me sick. They're all dancing around like they think Joni Mitchell might if she was there. You know, and everybody's, you know, overall tripping. And it makes my head seize up just even thinking about it. It's like a brain freeze. Anyway, I'm standing there, and I'd only been there like 5 minutes, and I was thinking all this stuff. I got to get out of here. I can't stand this place. And somebody walked by and handed me a can of malt liquor. And I'm thinking my first thought was, if my dad finds out I've got a can of malt liquor, he's going to kill me. If my mom finds out, and if Father O'Connor finds out that I've got a can of malt liquor, I'm in trouble, because I took the pledge when I turned 13, at confirmation not to drink till I was 21. This is all going through my head, you know. What would Father, maybe Father O'Neill would be a little, no, Father O'Neill's a rough one. Father O'Connor would be the kind of, oh, and I'm standing there with this can of malt liquor, and I figure no one's going to offer me a Pepsi. And I thought, what the hell? So I cracked that thing open and took a drink, and halfway through that can of malt liquor, it occurred to me, that had been way too hard on you people. You know what I mean? I got halfway through that can of malt liquor, and I started to feel that potential filling itself. I started to feel like a combination of John Lennon and Errol Flynn and David Niven all wrapped in this really irresistible cocktail. Single wine, ladies, no shoving. There's plenty for everybody. I never tested that out, but it seemed like a good idea at the time. But I just felt good. You know, I don't know why. I felt, on a half can of malt liquor, like I had discovered what it felt like to be a human being for the first time. I don't know why. You know, I know a lot of people that drink, and they drink a lot. They drink all the time. They don't ever get that feeling. They've never experienced that feeling. I take my first half can of malt liquor, and I am rocketed into the fourth dimension, you know. I feel like I'm a different human being. I liked you. I was interested in you now. You were the adversaries before. You were after me before. Now I'm interested. I think you're kind of cool. I think you're kind of okay. And I'm going to be a part of this. And I felt like I was a part of something. And I realized much later on that it was the first time in my life I hadn't felt completely self-absorbed. Completely. You know how you... I'm sure there have been two or three people in here who walk around feeling like there's a camera following them all the time, like their whole life is cinema verite, you know. And now, and then Charlie picked up a cup of coffee and had a serious thought. You know, and all of a sudden, half a can of malt liquor, and I feel like a different person. And if you're alcoholic, you get it. I didn't get drunk when I drank. People mistook it for drunk. But when I drank, I got there. I didn't get drunk, I got there. And there is that place I think every alcoholic remembers as that place where nothing's going to hurt you. Everything is going to be great in about 20 minutes. It's a level of anticipation that's almost orgasmic. It fills up your soul and it makes you feel like a complete human being because you know you're about to be there and everything is going to be all right. And I have never forgotten there. And I think of all my experience in AA, I've been sober for 36 years, that in my experience in AA, I have never seen an alcoholic who didn't at some point start to hear that voice of come back there again. Because I think that kills most of us. If Alcoholics Anonymous saves a lot of us, I think the memory of there kills most of us. Because you can be in the gutter, you can be peeing blood, you can be getting your head changed around with a cue stick, you can be having all kinds of things happening to you, and yet I will drink again if I remember where there is, and I have that inkling one more time. Because I know that there's so, I have a theory about this. Bear with me for a second, because it really borders on just brilliance. But I have a belief that there's a little nub in the back of my brain that is imperceptible by the human eye, but inside of that little part of my brain is the memory of there. And it's my job every day to not turn the pilot light on that memory. And what Alcoholics Anonymous has done, it's given me a full life that I would never trade, at least as far as I know today, at this moment, to roll the dice on there again. Because I can't, it'll destroy me. It'll destroy my life. And not in a dramatic way either. I'm not going to be, I hear people sometimes, I believe them, I think they're sincere. They go, you know, if I drink tonight, I'll be dead by tomorrow morning. I think, you know, if I thought I'd be dead by tomorrow morning, I might try it. Right? Because if I'm gonna drink and then just die, what a great way to go. But my problem is I'm going to live to be 90. I'll drink and I'll be, the next 30 years, 25 years will be, my life will go, it won't go like this. It's going to go, all the way down the line for the next 30 years until I'll just be that guy that lives in the abandoned apartment at the end of the building that coughs all day, you know? That's who I'm going to be. If I drink again, I'm not going to go out dramatically. I just will go out friendless, hopeless, and soulless. And, but I'll tell you, that night in 1968, you couldn't have told me that. That was the best thing I'd ever discovered, because if I hadn't had that experience, I don't know what I would have done as a person. I don't know what I would have done with all the feelings that I had inside that were so conflicting and so angry, mostly anger about something that I had no reason, no business to be angry. And yet I was, something gnawed at me all the time. And I drank whenever I could after that. I went to a blackout at that party. I don't know how that happened. Came out of the blackout holding on to my friend's door handle, running alongside of his car and vomiting all over myself and laughing my ass off, because I've been there. Once you're there, nothing is going to hurt you anymore. I'm going back there as quickly as I can. And I never forgot that. I really wanted that. And they say that, you know, we're like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde when we drink. And I'm like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Rogers when I drink. I drink and I just get the milk of human kindness going through my system. I feel like, you know, I'm alive and happy and I want to be everybody's friend, you know. And but when I'm sober, I'm ready to get, you know, get out the bump stock, if you know what I mean. But too soon. I drank for the next 12 years, pretty much like I drank that night. Yeah, I started drinking in blackouts pretty quickly. I didn't think they were such a bad deal. You know, when you first have a blackout, holy cow, I thought that's the closest thing to molecular transport as I'm ever going to experience. I'm standing in a party in Long Beach, rocking on my heels, holding my car keys, and then, whoop, Santa Monica, you know? This is great. I don't even remember being in the car. I just blinked and I'm home. It's like the old, you know, you see The Fly where they had that pod over here to go, and then he reassemble over here. That's how I felt. That's what blackouts did for me. It's like, wow, this is great. The only trouble is, like, you know, after the first time, you really can't get a command of when you're going to come out of a blackout. Usually there's an indication that you have an alcoholism problem anyway, because anybody who's non-alcoholic is going to come out of a blackout screaming, what happened? Where am I? Where was I? Oh God, I'm never going to drink again. This is all. Not me. Not you. I come out of blackouts, I'm not freaking out. I come out of a blackout like this. Kind of give it a dry check. You know, because I got a lot of reading to do. I've got to read, you know, where am I? Who are you? What's your tone of voice? Are you talking to me? You know, all that stuff in like a split second. And, but it's, you know, you just do it. It's just part of, that's what you pay. You know, you pay the dues to drink. And I drank for years and years. I don't have a dramatic story. I've never got it. I listen to Kathy and John and Ann, and I'm thinking they're going to really fall asleep during this story, because I've never come out of a blackout yelling, cover me, I'm going in. I've heard those stories in AA. I came out of a blackout and I was on a mountaintop yelling, keep going, men. The summit's just ahead. Not me. I've never come out of a blackout going, okay, cut the red wire. You know, I've never come out of a blackout saying much of anything. I've come out of blackouts with people saying stuff to me like, "Well, I bet that hurt." I drink and fall a lot. Anyway. That's how I drink. I just got drunk every day. I drink in bars. I love bars. I love the dirtier and sleazier, the better they are, you know. I was in one bar. I just remember the story. I've been sober for a while, and I just remembered the story about 5 years ago. And you know how you have those moments where all of a sudden some little nub in your brain gets unlocked for a moment, and you go, what? Really? That's real. I was drinking. I went into a bar in Anaheim. I'd never been in this bar before. I walk in, because I like to vary it up a little bit. Sometimes the humdinger gets a little too intellectual for me. I want to go over to the, you know, where they're beating each other's faces on the jukebox trying to change the number. E5. So I went to this bar, and I go and sit down. I get a beer, because it's all beer, and maybe a wine cooler, and then they have a big lab jar of pickled eggs that if you looked at them now, you'd never touch one. But then it's like, I'll take two of those. You know, it looks pretty good. Throw a couple of Slim Jims on top of that. I haven't had breakfast yet. And I'm sitting in this bar, and I look over, and there's a woman sitting in at the booth. There's a little booth in the back of the place. And she's sitting there in a chair facing into the booth, apparently waiting for somebody. And I'm looking at her thinking, I never see women in these bars, ever. Except the barmaids. So I thought, you know, I kind of got my stuff going. So I have a couple of drinks, and I go walking back there, but I don't want to stop right away. She's got a big slouch hat on, and she's holding a cigarette, and she's facing it. So I go in the bathroom, I kind of, you know, freshen up, and come back out, and I walk by the table, and I lean on the edge of the chair, and I lean over to look at her, and it's a mannequin. There's no way to react or something like that. And I went back and sat down at the bar, and there were probably 10 other guys sitting at the bar, and no one said a word. Because she hurt them too. So that's pretty much how I drank. There's nothing exciting about my drinking. It just got worse and worse. I got physically sick. I detached myself from every relationship and every friendship I ever had. I got married thinking that would help. It didn't. I thought, you know, 1 + 1, the two of us together will make one solid person. Isn't that a sad way to think, that it's going to take two of you to make one solid person? And I met her brother, who was my age, and he came over to the house, and she told me, no, listen, you cannot give him alcohol because he's been in institutions. And this is back in the mid-70s, early, probably 74, 75. He's been in institutions. He's been in hospitals. He's sick. And you can't let him drink because he gets in trouble when he drinks. So, okay. So he comes over. I get out the quart of Jack Daniels, you know, because that's my... I like a good phlegm cutter at the end of a hard day. You know, you throw one in a cup. And then you're just cooking. Everything starts to flow, and life is good. And so Bob comes over, and sure enough, you know, we put on some records and started drinking, having a great... We had a great time. We were connected and laughing and scratching and doing the whole thing. And I look over, and there's my wife standing in the doorway of the apartment. Which is... This is the international sign to men that you're not going to get a compliment. If a woman ever looks at you and goes like this, don't go. It's like that. It's like when you whack the newspaper on your leg for the dog. They don't come running up like they're going to get a treat. They come crawling up. And that's how she looks at me. She gives me one of these. I go, excuse me, Bob. So we go. She lets me in the bedroom, shuts the bedroom door, and she says, Bob, do not give him alcohol. I told you. Bob is an alcoholic. And I said, Bob is no more of an alcoholic than I am. The problem is you're a nag. And you need to back off, sister. And I turned around and walked out of that bedroom, and she's sobbing in there, so we just turned the stereo up. But 2 weeks later, Bob died. He drowned. He was drunk. He went into a lake and he didn't come out. He had a 5-year-old daughter at the time. and a wife that he had been estranged from, and who, you know, that was his. Those were his survivors, and he was a lovely guy. He was a really lovely guy. As most alcoholics, you know, you don't meet many alcoholics and aren't just beneath all the troubles and all the woes that their lives have become. You find you, if you scratch deep enough, you find a good soul in there that's just is given up. And my neighbor across the street from me, I moved into my house in 2000. This is after I've been sober for a while. I moved in with my wife at the time and our children. And my neighbor across the street's name is Tom. He's a really nice man. He worked at the studios. And he has nothing to do with alcoholism. He's not alcoholic at all. And he would come over if I had something broken and I needed help with something. He'd fix it for me because I'm clueless when it comes to working with anything with my hands. And Tom would come over and fix a chair leg or he'd fix a doorknob or something. And he got pancreatic cancer. He was probably 40 at the time. And so I was talking to his wife one morning in front of the house, and I said, "How's Tom doing?" And she said, "Well, he's in the hospital now. He's having surgery." And I said, "What's the surgery for? Are they going to can they get the cancer out?" And she said, no. That he's going to die of the cancer. But they're taking out parts of his stomach and his intestines and some of the organs around the tumor so that the tumor will have space to grow and he won't suffer too much through the holidays so he can spend the holidays with the kids before he goes. He's not going to live much past the holidays." And I don't mean to trivialize this man. I tell the story a lot, but I don't mean to trivialize his suffering. But isn't that exactly what alcoholism does to people like you and me? We cut out perfectly healthy parts of our lives in order to give a place for the disease to grow. We cut away friendships. We cut away opportunities. We cut away people who care about us. We cut away hope. We cut away our dreams. We cut away all that stuff just because I just want to have one more drink and this will help. This, once I get another couple of drinks in me, I'll be all right, and I can't stop. And I'm not a problem drinker. I'm an alcoholic. I can't, because if you take away the alcohol, you're taking away something really important in me. I don't know what I'll be if you take away the alcohol after drinking for 12 years. I don't know what's going to be left of me. I'd given everything up, pretty much. I didn't know it. I gave up that marriage to that woman who loved me. She was a great human being, and she loved me. And her deepest flaw in her character was that she loved me. And she thought she could help change me. And she couldn't. No one can change you. No one can take away from us what we are going to do as alcoholics. Except us. Except each of us. No one can convince me not to drink if I'm going to drink. Any more than anybody in here can convince a newcomer. I'm going to convince you not to drink tonight. If they're going to drink tonight, they're going to drink. And if they want to stay sober and they want what we have, they will do what we suggest and get that phone number that we gave them and call us. But you know as well as I do, if you're nervous about working around newcomers, you're kind of scared about what to say to them, the one way to always be free of ever having to work with a newcomer is to give them your phone number. Because giving a newcomer your phone number is like giving garlic to a vampire. They just, whoa, you know, a phone number? What am I going to do with that? You know, like it's a mystery. And so I got to AA on the 11th of June of 1981. My marriage had failed. I was living in, I'd started living in a converted garage in West LA. And then that became too oppressive. And I moved into my mom's house. Which is where all alcoholic men wind up eventually. If I ever open a substance abuse home and try to make money off of this thing, I'm going to call it my mom's house. And here's why. Because you get a lot of guys that go to these recovery houses called Phoenix House, Vesper House, you know, and you can really get the t-shirt, you know. Where do you live? Phoenix House. Where do you live? Vesper House. Where do you live? My mom's house. They'll get out of there quickly. They'll want to come to AA immediately and get out of a place called my mom's house. And so that's my thought. It's brilliant, I know. You can have the idea if you want. But anyway, I wound up living at my mother's house. She moved out, and thank goodness she had, because I'd already, you know, I'd really done enough to this lady. She'd had three babies that were born dead, and I couldn't understand why she would be concerned about me. I couldn't understand why my mom was so afraid all the time. You know? I didn't know it at the time that I was afraid all the time. All the time. I was always in a soup of fear. And I don't know where it came from. I have theories about it, but the theories don't mean anything. What matters is that I lived in fear, and I made every decision in my life based on fear rather than faith, or fear rather than hope, or fear rather than, what the heck, let's try this, something positive. But I backed off of everything. And I wanted to be in college, and I went to college. And I started college when I was 17. I got out when I was 30. A couple of detours along the way, and I got out. You know, I was a journalist and wanted to be a writer. Never could quite put the idea of wanting to be a writer and actually writing something together. You know, it's just a big chasm to jump over. But so I stayed. By the time, because I wanted to be a writer, I got a job at a bookstore. Because I thought if I was near publishing, I would probably, you know, osmosis, you start to become a writer by unloading books off of trucks. And so that's what I was doing. I was only there. It was a short stepping stone job. I was only going to do it until I got my writing career started, and I was there for like 13 years. And I've been going to therapy for a couple of years because I was asked. My wife said, go to therapy. So I went to this therapist that she was going to. The woman was great. I think therapy works for people. It just doesn't work for alcoholism. Because the prerequisite for therapy working, as I understand it, is the truth. You do the math. Most of us, especially when we're either drinking or we're in our first year of sobriety, you don't have a whiff of what the truth is yet. Not even a whiff. I heard a woman friend of mine named Julie who said one time, I hear people come into AA and they're very brave. And she says, it's very sweet to see them saying, I don't drink no matter what. You know, they're brand new. I don't drink no matter what happens, I don't drink. And she said, that's a good thing to have in your head, but you have no idea how deep the harbor of no matter what can be. No idea. And we come in here and, you know, we don't know what's going on. I got brought here, my sister-in-law, Bob's widow. My mother-in-law called me and said, would you take Debbie to an AA meeting? She's been in detox for the last 21 days, and she needs a ride to a meeting. And she'd been in this place called a care unit. This is back in 1981, before Betty Ford, before a lot of those places. But there was this care unit in the hospital in Santa Ana, I believe. And so I said, sure, I'll give her a ride, because I quit drinking. I've been to therapy for 2 years, and I went to the therapist retreat up in Casa de Maria in Montecito, which was just destroyed last week in a mud flow up there. But beautiful place to go for retreats and things. And I went up there for this retreat that this therapist was holding. And while I was up there, I had something happen while I was there. And I became desperate. And I went out for a walk on the grounds. A little too long of a story to tell. And I was going to kill myself. I was dead set serious. There was no drama involved in it. I thought, if I just hang myself, I'll be fine. I need to die. I don't want to die dramatic. I don't want any drama. I don't want people to try to talk me out of this. I just want to be lifted out of this life. I didn't ask to be here, but I can't stop drinking. I can't stop doing what I'm doing. I can't stop feeling the way I feel about everything. And I felt as desperate as I had felt the day before or the moment before I had that can of malt liquor. And I was, you know, I've been drinking for years. And I was desperate again. And I thought, I want to die. And I sat there in this beautiful grounds, and it occurred to me inside, I got a feeling that sounded like a voice, but it wasn't one. And it said that you are everything that you're afraid of, and I still love you. And I felt loved from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet. And I didn't know where it came from. And I thought I was going crazy. And I sat there and cried for a couple of hours, just feeling like, I don't know what's wrong with me. How can something love me and I feel this way about myself? What's happening to me? And I realize now that it was my belief, it was the intercession of a power that's much bigger than I am, probably the power that created me. Now, you may have an idea of how you were created, but I was raised Catholic. I went through the Baltimore Catechism. I had all the sacraments, you know. And I thought, how can this God have left me? I don't have a God. I don't believe in God. I didn't believe in God since I was 8 years old when that baby died that my mom was carrying. And I prayed for her. And that baby died after I prayed for my mom and prayed for that child. And the baby died. And I thought, God does not answer prayers because I didn't ask for anything except that they be okay. And they weren't okay. And I got sent home with no explanation, and I was angry. And I never thought about God as being anything but an irritating presence in the universe anyway. What kind of a God, you know? Forget it. He's up there with a good fine people up in his penthouse, you know, everybody kissing his butt. The people that do everything right, they put gloves in their glove compartment, you know, that kind of person. And and I hated him. I didn't hate him. I just disregarded him. And in the same way that I treated my dad with indifference, I treated my father with indifference my whole life. He died when I was 23. And I don't think I ever convinced him that I felt love for him. Even though I did, I just didn't show it. But I treated him like, you know, a shrug. And there I was, ready to kill myself, and had that feeling. And you think you've got a professional there, and you might want to tell this professional you'd have this experience in a meditation retreat. And I didn't say a word. I didn't say a word to her. I'm going to stick this out. You know, we carnies do this by ourselves, and we don't need your stinking help. And I went home that weekend, and I haven't had a drink since then. I fought it. I fought drinking for about a week. And then I got the call. Debbie needs a ride to this meeting, an AA meeting. I thought, oh, this is really lame. Debbie's going to AA. I thought we might have had something going on because my wife's getting a divorce from me, and I knew Debbie was, you know. Great expectations. And I said, sure, I'll pick her up. And I went over and got her in my beat up car, and now I'm detoxing. And I'm twitchy. And I'm hearing voices, and I've got the imaginary gnats that congregate right here, you know, and you go to look at them and they go away, and then you go back to whoever you're talking to and they're right back again, and all you have left to do is brush them away. So you're the only one in the back room of the bookstore sitting at the desk as people walk through and go, so I go pick Debbie up, and 20 minutes it took to get to the meeting place, and she had 22 days of sobriety, and she 12-stepped me, and she gave me this program in 20 minutes, and she only had 22 days. If you've got less than a year sober, say you've got 22 days or 10 days or 3 days, you've got something to share with somebody who has less time than you do. Because what she did saved my life, and she didn't know she was doing it. She told me later, I was just talking, I didn't really remember what I said, but she looked different, and she felt different, and she acted different, and I noticed it. And when we got there, we pulled up in front of the place, and she said, I said, when do you want me to come get you? And she said, why don't you come in the meeting with me? I said, I'm not alcoholic. And she said, that's okay, it's an open meeting, you don't have to be alcoholic. Visitors are welcome, and maybe if you come in, you'll hear, since you quit drinking this week, you'll hear something that might help you. And I couldn't defend myself against that kind of logic, and I parked the car and went in there. You know, I didn't like being here. I did not walk in and go, oh look, I'm home. I walked in going, oh my God. This is loserama. look at all these sad people laughing. They have no clue. They're whistling in the dark in here. This is terrible. I don't know why I'm even here. I just am here. I don't even... Hey, Charlie, are you new? I'm not new, because new would imply I'm going to stay and be old, and I'm not staying here. Hey, Charlie, you got a big book? A big book? I work in a bookstore. How big a book are we talking about? And I just had that sarcastic response to everything going on in here, because I couldn't take it. And, they, of course, Debbie brought me over to the literature lady, who was about 6 feet tall. She had a white outfit on. She had platinum blonde hair and a white cowboy hat. And she said, "You got a big book?" And I said, "No, I don't have a big book. She goes, "Well, here's a big book." I said, "How much is your big book?" And she says, $5. And I thought, you know what? I'll come back next week. I got $3 in my pocket. She goes, "How much you got?" And I said, I take out this crumpled up, you know how we are. Alcoholic men, there's something about alcoholic men. We can go out and drink all night, and at the end of the night, we can't make the rent, but we've got $700 worth of change in our pocket. Where that comes from, I have no idea. We've always got a mountain of change. But that night, I just had 3 crumpled up dollar bills, and I took them out, and I'm looking at them, and I said, "I'll come back." And she grabbed my hand, and she goes, "Wait a minute. This is only $2 for you tonight." I thought, "Do I look stupid?" Don't answer that. And she said, "Listen, tonight the big book is yours for $2. I'll just take $2 for it. If you want to buy one for somebody else at some point, do that. Or just pay it however you want to. But you don't owe me anything. The book is yours. And that other dollar you've got there, when that basket goes by, you put that dollar in the basket, because nobody around here stays sober on somebody else's dime." And so I go, "Okay." So when that basket went by, you can believe I'm sitting there. I don't know where she was in the room, but I had that dollar bill up in there. But I learned right at the beginning that we don't stay sober for free. We got to give something back. And at the end of the meeting, I was forced to thank the speaker. I said, "Why do I have to thank him?" And the woman who was sitting next to me said, "You thank him because he gave up his evening with his family to come here and talk to us, and he doesn't know us. He just came here to tell us what happened to him. The least you can do is get in line and say thank you." All right. Well, if you put it that way. And the next week I went back to the meeting, because Debbie was going to take a chip. They give chips out here. I was in a meeting last night. They were giving out chips. "Did you get a chip?" "A chip and a hug." "Oh." That's all I could think of. Debbie's going to get her 30-day chip. And everybody from the rehab was all excited. They went there, everybody from the care unit. There were 30 of them. They all sat at the same table. They compared wristbands. I felt less than, because I didn't have a wristband. Now, that should be the 21st question on the 20 questions. Is, do you feel less than because you don't have a hospital wristband? If you do, you are definitely an alcoholic. And I'm sitting there at the table with him, and Debbie gets up to take her 30-day chip, and people are crying and yelling and cheering. She gets up and takes her chip and comes back, and she gives it to me and says, "If you stay around 30 days, you'll get a chip and a hug too." And I thought, wow, nothing could make me happier than a chip and a hug. Thank you. And Chuck Chamberlain was a speaker the next week. I went the next week because Debbie drank after 32 days. And it took her 9 years to get back to AA and get sober again. And then I felt like I'd been abandoned in AA. So I go back the next week, and I'm really desperate. I'm terrified now, because I don't know any of these people. I knew Debbie, and now she's gone, so now what? And they gave me a commitment as a greeter, and I'm the worst greeter. I'm like the guy they found at the mortuary and brought him up to hire him. "Welcome to AA. Get out while you can." These people are all crazy here. So, the speaker that night was Chuck C. And I thought, oh God, everybody's hush in the room. Chuck C's coming. I thought, regional celebrity. And Chuck came in, and anybody who ever heard Chuck speak in person, he's a charismatic, wonderful guy. No pretense about him. He's just Chuck, the little man, the little white-haired guy. And he spoke. I didn't understand a word he said. He just chuckled the whole time. Surrender. What do you get when you give half measures of value? Nothing. You think they give you 50%, but they get you nothing. And I'm sitting there for 10 minutes going, well, 50% should give you 50%, at least. And then he's gone, so people said, well, go up and thank Chuck. And I thought, thank him? I didn't understand a word he said. You know? And they said, just go up and thank him. So I was the last person in line. And I get up there to thank Chuck, and he gets my hand, and he's looking at me, and he goes, how long are you sober, boy? And I said, 20 days. And he goes, God, I love you. And he threw his arms around my arms, and he kissed me. Like a grandpa. And it startled the hell out of me. And I realized that that was the night I caught alcoholism. Chuck Chamberlain had a virulent strain of alcoholism, and I caught it. But then I heard him speak like 8 times in the next 3 months that I was sober. It was just everywhere I went. Chuck C. speak, and I thought, well, there's another 40 minutes. I'm not going to understand a word he's saying. And about the carpenter and the, you know, all the parables from the Bible. And I didn't get it. And but I stayed. And I got a sponsor. I got a sponsor because I wanted you to shut up about getting a sponsor. I didn't get a sponsor to help me. I got a sponsor to shut you up. You know? So when you came up and said, hey, Charlie, you got a sponsor yet? I go, yeah, him, right there. That guy, go ask him. And I got the biggest... He was really nice to me until I asked him to sponsor me. Then he kind of turned on me. But he had 7 years. And he came, you know, he shook my hand. He was very warm. And he gave me a list of things to do. He said, I want you to get to meetings an hour early. I want you to shake people's hands before the meeting and get phone numbers from the men. I want you to call people during the day. I want you to call me every day in the morning. I want you to stick around after the meeting and go to coffee with people to get to know AA people outside of the meetings. I want you to thank the people that participated at the podium during the coffee break. Just walk up to them and say thank you for what you had to say. And I want you to, every morning, I want you to get on your knees and talk to God. Talk to a power bigger than you are. And I thought, I can do that other crap even though I don't want to. I don't want to shake people's hands. How are you? Like, I care. I don't like people. I straight-armed them for months. It's like, hi, I'm Charlie. You know, and until I finally got to bend my elbow a little bit when they came in. And I got their numbers and I called. I did everything he said, even though I hated it, because I was desperate. And I knew what the alternative was, and that was I would drink again. I know I would. I'm an alcoholic. I know I will drink again. And I went to him one time, and I was desperate. And I said, I wonder, when am I going to have the miracle this program brings? And he said, what are you talking about? I said, when are we going to do the steps? He said, what? I said, the steps. When are we going to do the steps? I just talked to somebody in another meeting. He said, he and his sponsor got on their knees and said, did the third step. And they had all this writing for the first two steps and all these things he was doing for the... And he said, I don't do that. I don't do it that way. And I said, well, when am I going to have a spiritual awakening? And he said, do I look psychic? Do I look like I know when you're going to have a spiritual awakening? Don't worry about it. When you have it, you'll know it. It won't be a mistake. You'll get it. You know? But don't ask me when you're going to have it because I don't know. And I thought, oh, great. You know? And I'm doing everything. I'm doing everything. Everything he asked. Service work. You name it. 12-step calls, cleaning, mopping. I was the premier floor mopper in my group for months, just for years, actually. But up at this point, it was months. And, you know, was not getting it. And I hear people, there's somebody come into a meeting. On one Tuesday, I heard a woman come into a meeting and go, I got 7 months sober. And I haven't been to an AA meeting in 6.5 months. But I came back today and I had a spiritual awakening. I've been here for 8 months. I've been cleaning the floors, calling people, praying to my bedspread, going out for coffee, listening to everybody talk about this and that, going to Clancy's yard and playing softball, which I hate softball, but I go. I do everything I'm asked to do. I don't like it, but I'm 8 months sober now, and I don't think AA is working. But still no sign of God. This bitch comes back for 1 day. one day, and all of a sudden she's God's BFF. Look, it's me and God. Just exasperating, you know. But I couldn't tell my sponsor because he turned on me. I knew it. 2 weeks later, I'm mopping the floor on Sunday night at my home group Sunday night meeting. And I pull all the pews away. I got these two other losers that are mopping too, and we're all sober now still. And mopping the floors, and I paused for a second, and I looked at the people that were lined up to thank the speaker. And I knew every single one of them by their name, and I liked them. I didn't know how that happened. And I stood there almost trembling, holding this mop, going, if I could be anywhere else in the world, if I could be promised to go anywhere else in the world right now, I wouldn't want to be anywhere but standing right where I am in my shoes with this feeling inside of me that I feel so connected to everybody in here. And this is a guy who hates people. And I trusted you with my life. And I told Bill about it. I got home and called him. And I told him what happened. And he said, you had a moment of grace. That's what a moment of grace is about. That's not a spiritual awakening yet. You'll have that. But that moment of grace is the beginning for you. Because what it is you've done enough to let God out to play. And I don't believe in a God that lives in the rafters or up there. I believe that there's a God in every single living thing right in here. That if I can get out of my way, out of my selfishness, out of my self-centeredness, and try to be useful to people, and ask God to please come out and show himself, he will show himself, but not my God, not the one in me. He'll show himself through you. I'll see him in you. I'll go, okay, I get it. God is never going to present himself to me and from myself. But when I recognize him as somebody else in here, somebody who is suffering, someone who I've seen come in new, just a beaten up wreck with a kid, dragging that kid across the floor, and brat squalling, you know, and it's all. And then I see this person take a chip 30 days later, and she's become a little bit more, with her head up a little higher. And then 6 months later, she takes a chip, and she's got that child who's happy to see their parent, their mom there taking this chip. And you see them a year later sponsoring somebody. And you know something's happening in this room. Something's going on. And it's not you, and it's not me, but it's us. And we need to share that message of what's happening in here so that we can all surrender enough and I can lower my guard enough to let God come out and play so that I can learn that there's a benevolent power in here that I can turn and trust my will and my life to, which I found. You know, I've gotten married in the last 9 years. I married a woman I just adore. I got married earlier in sobriety, and that turned into a disaster. And we had two children, which even makes, you know, there's the icing on the cake for disaster. I have two teenagers now. I'm 67, and I'm now raising teenagers, which is okay. I just, you know, do what I can, but at least I didn't have them any later. Because at least when I had them, I could still throw them in the air and catch them, you know, like you do with babies. But now it's going to have to be one or the other if I had a kid now. And I, you know, okay, honey, I'm going to throw you in the air. Anybody? I call my kids during the day, and people would walk up and they go, "Oh, Grandpa's got the kids for the day." And I go, "Nope, they're mine." Still got it. Which is not entirely true because I had it taken care of about 10 years ago. But anyway, I met a woman who was sober for a while, and she's gotten divorced, and we hit it off, and we got married, and she's just a joy in my life. She's a wonderful stepmother to my children who've lived with me full-time for the last 10 years, and my life has changed. I don't fear everything anymore. I don't fear. I just try to move forward. And I don't succeed all the time. And you're not looking at a model of Alcoholics Anonymous and sober living up here. You're looking at a guy just like you who is unsure but who believes that at some point I have to say, okay, I believe that God or whatever you want to call this power is in my life, is going to walk me through this. It's never let me go before. It's never dropped me before. I'll tell you a story and I'll sit down. My dad, I made amends to my mom, and the last thing my mom said to me before she died, which she's which was about 6 hours before she died, was "I love you." And that was not, my mom was, you know, we had a really difficult relationship, but this program healed that relationship. And my father died when I was 23. I just turned 23 of cancer. He was 60. And my father, I treated him, like I said, indifferently for my whole life. And my dad, you know, he got up every morning. He worked at McDonnell Douglas as a carpenter on airplanes on the inside. And he'd get up every morning. He'd have to leave the house at 6 in the morning. So he'd get up at 4 because he was a farm boy from Minnesota. And he would make lunch for me. He'd put a sandwich and fruit and chips or something in a bag and put my name on it. You know, and we didn't have a lot of money, but my dad always made sure I had lunch. And he put it there by the door. And I'd get up a few hours later, long after he'd gone to work, and I'd walk by and snatch that lunch off the counter and walk to school. And I'd cross the border at the property line at school, and I'd just drop it in the trash can and keep moving. Because cool kids don't carry their lunch. They buy their lunch. You know, carrying your lunch is a sign of being lame. And so I chucked it in the trash. I did that for years. Years, every day. And every day when I see my father, when he came home, he'd come whistling up the walkway at home, and I would treat him with indifference. Hi. You know, he wanted a relationship with his son. I wasn't going to give it to him. Not purposely. I loved that man. I honored that man inside, but I couldn't get over my own crap, my own justification. And so every day that lunch went in the trash, and every day he would come home, and it was just like a twist in my inside that just tightened up on me every time I saw him. And I felt guilty, and I felt ashamed. And so I made amends to him. I took direction from my sponsor and made amends at my father's grave. I found his grave. I went there. A guy named Clint Hodges had described making amends to his mom at her grave, so I followed exactly what Clint did. I got some Windex, and I got some scissors, and I got some paper towels, and I cleaned that grave off as best I could. It wasn't bad, and I put a carnation on it because my dad loved the smell of carnations, and I sat down, and I told him about you, and I told him that I'd been a mess, and I hadn't listened to anything he did, and now I'm with people that are teaching me what he tried to teach me, and I'm seeing the honor in that, and in doing that, I feel more honor toward him, and I'm so sorry that I couldn't do that for you when you're alive. I'm so sorry I couldn't tell you that when you were alive, but I'm trying to do the best I can now, and I'm in good hands, and I hope you know that you're in peace. I'm in good hands now, you know, but not because of what I had, but because of what you set down some foundation for me, and these people brought me back to it. And I left, no lights, you know, I didn't feel any shafts of light come down, you know what I mean? And, but I realized when I talked about my dad, because I knew he'd been disappointed in me. He was an athlete, I was a wheezing asthmatic. And but when I talked about my dad, I didn't feel like he'd been disappointed in me. I never felt that before. And then I went to my mom, and I told her, I got to tell you this because I couldn't tell him. But every day I used to throw my lunch away in the trash that Dad would make for me. And she says, "Yeah, I know." And I said, "How do you know?" And she said, "Well, your dad told me." I said, "How did he know?" She said, "Oh, every so often he'd ask you how the apple was in your lunch, and he'd say it was great and it was an orange. He'd ask you if the bologna sandwich was good, and you'd say, yeah, it's perfect, and it would be peanut butter." But he didn't ask it very often, he just was checking. And I said, "Well, if he knew that I was throwing this lunch away every day, why did he keep making it for me?" And my mom looked at me across the table like I was the dumbest person she'd ever set eyes on. It's like she was shocked, and I got it instantly, that he just loved me. He just did it because that's the way he was going to show love to the only son he had. And he didn't care if I threw that lunch away or what I did with it. He took the joy out of making the lunch and putting it in the bag and putting my name on the bag and setting it by the door for me. And whatever I did with it afterward was my business. He took the joy already. He didn't need my approval for his joy. And that's the same way it is here. People came here and put out cookies, made coffee, set up the chairs, put out, you know, literature somewhere. They're raising money to have a conference. And these are all things that people have other things to do with their time, right? They have something that could be done better with their time. It's Friday night, you know, and here we are.
But I'll tell you something, they did it because it's love. It's an act of love. It's a dry-eyed humility. It doesn't ask for acknowledgement. It doesn't ask for a pat on the head. It just is, and you'll get the reward later, and it's a surprise. It always comes as a happy surprise. And so if you're here tonight, and you're new, and you're suffering, or if you've been here a while, and you're suffering, there's love in this room. There are people that want to hear about your suffering, or want to hear about what problem you're in, and maybe they can help you. But this is the place where you'll get it. And this is the place where you come back to so you don't ever have to drink again and live in the hell of alcoholism again. So thank you for having me. I appreciate it.